Cool. So I'm really just going to make a handful of pretty key arguments in this talk. And they can sort of be summed up as, one, Stalin was fucked and trashed the international left for just decades. And two, Lenin didn't lead to Stalin. And revolutions, contrary to sort of what everyone from the conservative right to reformist to your high school history teacher said, revolutions do not automatically lead to dictatorships. But before we get into sort of Stalin's bullshit, it's worth covering a little bit about the Russian Revolution in 1917. Just by a show of hands, who was here for Xavier's session here just a minute ago? Yeah, okay, that's pretty good. Well, for the small number of people who missed it, shame. But basically, this was just the most democratic event in world history, I would argue. It was a time when workers, soldiers, and peasants elected representatives from their workplaces to councils or soviets, which began to transform society completely. Unlike our parliaments, these representatives weren't sort of separate from their workmates. They didn't get special pay and conditions or anything like that. And also, unlike our politicians, who can only be replaced every couple of years, the delegates that were elected to these Soviets were instantly recallable, and so they had to genuinely champion the politics of the workers they represented. And, you know, through this sort of revolutionary process, under the once these Soviets took power, they set about sort of fucking off all the bosses and landlords, and they implemented a whole range of radical democratic reforms that actually are sort of still unmatched to this day. So not only did they end World War I, give land to the peasants, and give everyone the right to vote, they also abolished inherited wealth completely, granted self-determination for national minorities and complete freedom of religion, set up communal kitchens and childcare centres to free women from domestic labour, and even granted abortion and divorce on demand, and recognised same-sex marriages. A whole bunch of reforms that, you know, we still haven't won to this day in actually pretty much most of the world. So how is this sort of radically democratic and progressive society replaced by the repressive authoritarian regime of Stalin? The short answer to this question is that the revolution didn't spread internationally. And there are a couple of reasons that this is really important. The first is sort of economic. So industrial capitalist production is international. It draws in resources from across the entire world into vast sort of production chains. You know, just look around you from, you know, the clothes on your back to the chair you're sitting in, and guarantee you it's passed through, you know, at least a dozen countries. And this means that no sort of individual country's economy is self-sustaining. And this was especially true in Russia. Despite having some of the world's most advanced factories in, you know, some little particular areas, most of the populations were peasants. And the income per person in Russia immediately before the war was 20% lower than Britain in 1688. So this is just a massively underdeveloped country with, yeah, really, by historic standards, very, very few resources. So there was no way Russian society could continue to function without the aid of workers from more industrially advanced countries. The economy would just collapse. The second reason that revolution had to spread internationally was more of a sort of political reason. And this is that because capitalism is international, the backlash is international. Within a year of the revolution, Russia had been invaded by 14 countries that had just basically stopped turning their guns on each other from World War I and decided to gang up on this new sort of revolutionary workers' state. And those countries actually included Australia as well. By 1918, this sort of coalition of imperialist powers sent over 300,000 troops, as well as tons of cash and weapons to Russia, to support the counter-revolutionary White Army that fought with the Soviets in the Civil War. So with Western backing, this White Army basically tried to drown the revolution in blood. They murdered workers and trade unionists and handed factories back to the bosses. They also murdered tons of peasants and handed land back to the landlords. And just for good measure, they murdered literally hundreds of thousands of Jews in brutal pogroms. Although the Russian counter-revolutionaries, the Russian revolutionaries won the civil war in the end, without support from international revolutions, all of these sort of economic and political problems that I outlined were basically compounded. It was a bit of a sort of pyrrhic victory. So, on one hand, economic collapse and war decimated the Russian working class and the Bolshevik Party. There was a 60% reduction in the number of industrial workers in the country from 1917 to 21. And in Petrograd, which had been the center of the revolution, the number of workers fell from 2.4 million in 1917 to 570,000 in 1920. And realistically, this actually underestimates the scale of the decline, because it was the most class-conscious and political workers who had volunteered to fight in the war and were the first to die, So the Bolshevik Party itself was completely transformed. While membership of the party grew from tens of thousands in 1917 to millions in 1919 to 1920, this was because a wave of careerists and bureaucrats signed up to make sure they were on the winning side. And the sort of number of serious revolutionaries who were in the party dwindled by comparison. So by 1922, only 1 in 40 party members had been active Bolsheviks in 1917. And so the other side of this is that, like I mentioned, the economy continued to collapse even more. So from 1913 to 1920, industrial output dropped by another 80%, considering it was already on this extremely low level. And when people are, including actually the members of the Soviet executive, are starving, it's actually quite hard to do politics and let alone build socialism. So all of these sort of economic and political problems were reflected in and sort of consolidated by Stalin. And his plan to abandon international revolution and build socialism in one country was sort of the pinnacle of this. In order to compete with foreign capitalists economically and militarily, the USSR tried to industrialize it at any cost. So as Stalin argued at the time, quote, "We are 50 or 100 years behind the advanced countries. We must make up this gap in 10 years. Either we do it or they will crush us." So the way that Stalin set about achieving this very, very ambitious plan was basically by hyper-exploiting the workers and the peasants. So workers were no longer allowed to run the factories themselves. In fact, a lot of labor was done just through forced labor in gulags. Land was sort of collectivized, which sounds nice and left-wing, but actually meant driving the peasants off the land and turning them into sort of cheap labor in the cities. And mass famine was allowed to, run rife in the country while the state exported grain for gold to fund industrialization. So making, this is obviously horrific, but in order to actually enforce it, Stalin basically had to make workers, peasants, and Bolsheviks, had to repress them. So in the workplace, workers could now be jailed for years for leaving or quitting a job without permission. Strikes were punishable by death. And the progressive reforms of the revolution were pretty much completely reversed. The nuclear family was reinstated, abortion and divorce were banned, and there was a sort of a new nationalism coalesced as self-determined for sort of minorities and other national groups was just completely junked. And this was mirrored again within the party. So sort of the democracy and vibrant political debate that people would have heard about in the previous session on the Russian Revolution was completely replaced by a set of sort of unaccountable officials and sort of secret police who murdered Stalin's critics. Stalin also deliberately recruited more and more apolitical bureaucrats into the party to help dilute the revolutionary politics that had once dominated and sort of purge his opponents. And by 1940, every single leading Bolshevik from 1917 was dead or in prison. So the upshot of this entire very grim picture is basically that the material abundance and political leadership required for socialism was just completely smashed. And a new bureaucratic class led by Stalin took power and sort of filled this power vacuum that came to exist. Now there are sort of three points that I think are worth underlining in all of this. The first is that, like I said to begin with, far from laying the ideological basis for Stalin, Lenin was the complete opposite of this and was highly critical of these developments all the way up until he died in 1924. So in 1922, he warned that, quote, you know, the responsible communists were being led by the massive bureaucrats rather than the other way around. In 1923, he began, he organized opposition alongside Trotsky and tried to involve more workers and peasants in the government as a counterweight to the bureaucrats. And even on his deathbed in 1924, he wrote a document arguing that Stalin was basically a piece of shit and should be replaced by Trotsky. The document was suppressed, though. The second sort of important point in this is that the sort of hope that revolutionaries held out for international revolution, this wasn't some sort of naive fantasy. During World War I, revolutions broke out all across Europe, from sort of Finland, Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, Italy, and especially Germany, which was the most industrially advanced country in the world, aside from the US at the time. and where workers, you know, toppled the Kaiser and set up workers' councils and things like that of their own in 1918. So in order to kind of, I think, really grasp how, you know, the high tide of this sort of revolutionary wave, I think it's best to listen to British Prime Minister Lloyd George at the time, who said, "The whole of Europe is filled with the spirit of revolution. There is a deep sense, not only of discontent, but of anger and revolt amongst the workmen against pre-war conditions. The whole existing order in its political, social, and economic aspects is questioned by the masses of the population from one end of Europe to the other." So clearly quaking in his boots. And so, yeah, this, yeah, the sort of third thing I wanted to highlight here again is that, again, so it's not just sort of some naive fantasy, and it's, yeah, it's not something that was sort of encouraged, yeah, the sort of Stalinist reactionary wave wasn't encouraged by Lenin, but also that, like, there were other revolutionaries positively arguing for the revolution to spread at the time, and understood this even as they went into the Russian Revolution. So, you know, Trotsky, on the eve of the October Revolution, argued that, you know, we rest all our hope on the possibility that our revolution will unleash the European Revolution. If not, we'll be crushed. Lenin, in 1918, argued that it is the absolute truth that without a German revolution, we are doomed. And Rosa Luxemburg, you know, notable revolutionary in Germany, yes, wrote that... "If the Russians are not able to maintain themselves in this witch's Sabbath, it would not be because economic development in Russia is too backward, but because the social democracy in the highly developed West consists of pitifully wretched cowards who, looking quietly on, will let the Russians bleed themselves to death." And the Russian revolutionaries also didn't just sort of hope and pray for support from workers abroad. They devoted considerable resources in the early years to supporting and encouraging these sort of revolutions. But at the end of the day... the revolutionaries who, you know, survived in Russia couldn't make up for the lack of a well-organized mass party of revolutionary workers in these other countries. There was simply no equivalent to the Bolsheviks to take the lead in a revolution, and in that, you know, in doing that, give support to the Russians. What actually happened was that, kind of led by these pitifully wretched cowards, the workers' revolutions in Europe were defeated, and so the sort of influx of revolutionary workers and economic support that could have halted the rise of Stalin never came, and the Russian Revolution was soundly defeated from inside. So that sort of covers, I guess, the history of Stalin's rise to power and the actual balance of social forces that made that possible. So now I want to move on to the impact of Stalinism internationally outside of Russia. Yeah, I'm short on time. I might cut some stuff. But basically, the first result is sort of ideological, I think. So Stalinists and their Western capitalist counterparts both argued that, you know, because the USSR was communist, that meant communism is when bureaucratic states direct production and control workers, but also maybe sometimes fly red flags and oppose some other Western capitalist states. And this sort of completely distorted vision of communism completely erases and subordinates the role of workers. And really, yes, obscures the inspiring legacy of the Russian Revolution. And the second sort of related impact that Stalinism had internationally and on the left is maybe a bit more concrete, which is that Stalin and his mates directly intervened and undermined revolutions in all sorts of other places around the world. They essentially turned the different sort of national communist parties everywhere into just arms of Russia's new sort of foreign policy. There are tons of examples on this, but I might just go into one that I've been reading about for the session on Chinese Trotskyism tomorrow, which is about sort of China in the lead up and during the 1925 to 27 revolution. According to Trotsky, this was, quite, you know, the greatest event of modern history after the revolution of 1917 in Russia. But such is the bitter irony of history, he wrote, the experience of the Russian Revolution not only did not help the Chinese proletariat, but on the contrary, it became, in its reactionary, distorted form, one of the chief obstacles in its path. So what Trotsky is describing here, essentially, is that is the way that Stalin's idea of socialism in one country and the sort of social forces that represented drove the USSR to make peace with international capitalism and just basically pick sides in different, you know, imperialist wars and, yeah, just global conflicts, rather than actually try and foster working class revolution. So in China, what this meant was the USSR helped create a Chinese Communist Party, But rather than fighting for socialist workers' revolution, the USSR wanted, a reliable capitalist ally against the British on its sort of eastern flank. So it also, at the same time, trained, funded, and literally wrote the founding documents for a bourgeois nationalist party. And then what it did was tell the communists to join the nationalist party and maintain their alliance with it at all costs. So in practice, what this meant was that the Chinese Communist Party constantly tried to rein in workers' and peasant struggles to placate the capitalists and landlords in the Nationalist Party. And they even did this in situations where workers took power in major cities and established their own version of the Soviets. And even after the Nationalists betrayed them and then slaughtered tens of thousands of workers and peasants and crushed these revolutions, still the USSR insisted that the Communists ally themselves with these Nationalists. And they basically repeated this over and over again for the whole sort of period up until 1927, until eventually the Chinese Communist Party lost its mass base in the working class because they were obviously disillusioned with this fucking stupid strategy. And the party itself, the Chinese Communist Party, was transformed sort of into a left nationalist peasant army rather than a sort of mass workers' party. And so over the course of the Chinese Civil War that sort of followed, it basically led to the establishment of a similarly authoritarian, bureaucratic, anti-worker regime under Mao. And there are, there are other examples of this, but maybe people can raise them in the discussion, sort of about the influence of Stalinism then on communist parties and socialist movements in the West. But I might just, I might just move on. So to sort of the main points, I guess, to wrap up, that sort of, even though Stalinists are basically irrelevant today, like they don't really exist except for little niche corners of the internet where they sort of share memes or whatever, I think it's still important for socialists to understand this history. Not only, to counter sort of right-wingers, liberals, social democrats, other people just around the left or whatever, but also to have a clear sense of what it is that, we're fighting for. There's... like I said to begin with, I think the two sort of main lessons are that, this sort of dictatorship, this wasn't some inevitable outcome. This was something that happened because of the failure or the inability of revolution to spread because people weren't organized enough in these other countries. Stalin basically embodied the defeat, not the sort of continuation of Lenin and this sort of the Bolshevik Party. And these sort of dictatorships that emerged were the result of too little, not too much revolution, actually. Because capitalism is an international system, to succeed anywhere, socialist revolution has to spread everywhere, essentially. And the idea that communism is about sort of just choosing one or another authoritarian state is just complete bullshit. Communism is about workers all over the world running society collectively and democratically and ending exploitation and oppression once and for all. And that's what we're fighting for today, and that's what you should fight for too.